coming up on Star Stuff. The first stars in the universe, younger than previously thought. New discoveries hoping to explain how tectonic plates move. And a previously unknown dark matter galaxy discovered on the far side of the Milky Way. All that and more coming up on Star Stuff.
This is Star Stuff.
New maps from the European Space Agency's Planck satellite have shown that the first stars began shining a little later than previously thought. Planck studies the early universe by examining the cosmic microwave background radiation, the so-called afterglow of the Big Bang, the event which brought the universe into existence 13.8 billion years ago. 380,000 years after the Big Bang, the universe had cooled enough for subatomic particles, protons and electrons, to combine to form the very first atoms. Once these first atoms, mostly hydrogen and helium, formed, photons of energy could escape, and we see these photons today as the cosmic microwave background radiation. It covers the entire sky at micro wavelengths. In fact, those of you with analog TVs and radios can pick up the cosmic microwave background as the white noise between channels. The average temperature of the cosmic microwave background radiation now is about 2.7 degrees above absolute zero. But it's not uniform. There are slight differences in that temperature. Those differences trace regions of slightly different density in the early universe. And that represents the seeds of all future structure, stars and galaxies that we see in the cosmos today. Consequently, this cosmic microwave background radiation provides a sort of high-resolution image of the detailed structure of the universe when it was some 40,000 times younger than it is now. As the universe continued to cool, eventually molecular clouds of hydrogen and helium began to form and collapse under their own gravity, creating the very first stars and galaxies. And as these first stars began to shine, their light began to reionize the universe, ending the so-called cosmic dark ages. And it's this time, this period of reionization, which ended the cosmic dark ages, that Planck has now narrowed down. The new Planck data places this time at about 550 million years after the Big Bang. That's over 100 million years later than previously thought. The discovery helps solve a long-standing problem. You see, previous studies of the cosmic microwave background radiation's polarization pointed towards an earlier dawn for the first stars, while some very deep images of the sky indicated that the earliest known galaxies in the universe formed perhaps 300 to 400 million years after the Big Bang. But the calculations indicate these would not have been powerful enough to bring an end to the cosmic dark ages within, say, 450 million years. And that's why this new evidence from Planck is so important. It significantly reduces the problem, indicating that the earliest stars and galaxies alone might have been enough after all. The new findings are based on the polarization of light from the cosmic microwave background. See, light is polarized when it vibrates in a preferred direction, something that may arise as a result of photons bouncing off other particles like electrons. And this is exactly what happened when the cosmic microwave background radiation originated in the early universe. As the cosmic microwave background radiation traveled through space and time, this light was influenced by the first stars, and the polarization data now indicates that these started to shine about 550 million years after the Big Bang. These first-generation stars are unique because they're composed almost entirely of hydrogen and helium, with only trace amounts of lithium and beryllium, simply because that's all there was. There were no other elements in the universe at this time. All the other elements we see in the periodic table were first produced by those first-generation stars, either during their lives or when they died in supernova explosions. Because of this unique quality, these first-generation stars have very different properties from all the stars we see around us today. These first generation of stars were all highly luminous, massive blue giants between around 20 and 130 times the mass of our Sun. Being so large also meant that they used up their fuel supplies really quickly, and so may only have had lifespans of a few million years compared to the 12 billion-year life cycle of a star like our Sun. Professor of Astronomy at Cambridge, Richard McMahon, says these early first-generation stars looked very different.
They're about 1,000 times more massive, 1 million times brighter. And inside these stars, the first oxygen is created, the same oxygen that's on the Earth. So literally, we are children of these first stars.
These first-generation stars have not yet been directly observed. However, indirect evidence of their existence has been found in a gravitationally lensed galaxy in a very distant part of the universe. First-generation stars are also thought to be key components of what are termed faint blue galaxies. The new Planck polarization data is also telling scientists about the foreground emission of gas and dust in the Milky Way galaxy. The data shows that the polarization emission of dust in our galaxy is significant over the entire sky. And this polarized emission beautifully traces galactic magnetic fields, providing unprecedented insights into the complex weather phenomena of our Milky Way galaxy. However, the Planck data has also dashed hopes from the BICEP2 group, the scientists who hoped that they had detected gravitational waves in the cosmic microwave background radiation. These gravitational waves would have been telltale signs of cosmic inflation, the sudden faster-than-light expansion of the universe in nanoseconds after the beginning of time. Cosmic inflation is important because it's needed to explain why the universe looks pretty much the same in all directions, despite the fact that it's been expanding for 13.8 billion years. A surprise discovery has shown scientists how Earth's tectonic plates slide across the top of the planet's mantle on what amounts to be a low viscosity layer of rock. Researchers were using explosives to collect seismic data on the plate boundary subduction zone between 15 and 30 kilometres below the earthquake-prone New Zealand capital of Wellington. The scientists were surprised to find they were getting good echoes and reflections back from nearly 100 kilometres deep, where the base of the tectonic plates interact with the underlying upper mantle. The discovery, reported in the journal Nature, provides new insights into how tectonic plates move. Scientists have known for over half a century that the Earth's surface is composed of a series of tectonic plates. Convection generated by heat deep inside the planet causes these plates to move across the surface and subduct under one another at plate boundaries, causing earthquakes, tsunamis, and volcanic activity. However, scientists have long debated the process by which the plates move across the surface. The study's lead author, Professor Tim Stern from Victoria University in Wellington, says his team's detected seismic reflections from the base of the oceanic plate showing a channel of melt or water facilitating the motion of the plate over the mantle. Stern says the sharpness of the transition zone boundary indicates more than just a slight temperature change. It actually points to a phase change, suggesting a partial melt in the rocks. The data indicates two parallel 1 kilometre thick transition zones between the base of the oceanic plate and the upper mantle. The two transition zones are about 10 kilometres apart and are believed to form the upper and lower boundary of a channel of pooled, partially melted material. The channel appears to be solid, but it contains about 2% melt, and that's enough to decrease the strength of the material quite markedly. Consequently, the viscosity drops by a large amount. The discovery also implies that the movement of tectonic plates is governed by the pull and push from its edges, rather than from the convective mantle below, coupling to the bottom of the plate. In other words, the weight of the subducting material going down is dragging the rest of the plate with it, a process known as slab pull. Stern says there's also a component of ridge push there because the mid-ocean ridges are at a much higher altitude in the middle of the ocean, so there's a gravitational push as well from the ridges helping to move the plates along. The high-resolution data, some 10 times better than anything previously received, was generated by measuring reflections in seismic waves produced by a series of 12 explosive detonations drilled across the lower North Island. Each detonation consisted of around 500 kilograms of explosive slurry poured into 50-meter-deep steel-encased boreholes. Stern says his team simply never anticipated such a fantastic penetration of energy down to such great depth. He says when combined with new techniques in seismic reflection processing, the data's allowed the team to obtain the most detailed images yet of the bottom of an oceanic tectonic plate.
So what we've done is what's called a multi-channel seismic reflection profile. using dynamite, deep boreholes across the southern North Island of New Zealand. The project was really to investigate the top of the subduction zone as it goes under the North Island, which is a depth of roughly 15 to 30 kilometres beneath the Wellington City area, because this is an area where we have major earthquakes, and the project was designed to investigate the mechanical processes going on in the plate boundary zone. But what was surprising to us, and we hadn't anticipated, was that we got this fantastic penetration of energy down to great depths and got echoes or reflections back from nearly 100 kilometres deep. And it turns out that this is the base of the plate, these tectonic plates, which actually make up the solid surface of the Earth, the top sort of 1% of the Earth, actually have a base to them, and we managed to image that.
And so this is basically where the lithosphere meets
the asthenosphere, which is the part of the mantle which starts to flow and is viscous and is defined by a temperature roughly around about 1100 degrees, where we change from a more rigid mantle into the somewhat viscous with a very small percent of partial melt.
And what happens at this lithosphere-asthenosphere boundary?
It's generally thought that if the rocks beneath this boundary flow, so that if you put pressure, if you load the surface of the Earth, the plate will bend and it will push down into this boundary and into this layer below. So it's thought that the rocks can flow on a time scale of hundreds of thousands of years to millions of years, that it will be actually quite sort of sticky tar-like and flow. For many years, people thought of it as a very gradational boundary. Our project was that previous to using explosions to investigate this boundary, we used earthquake waves, and there's been many studies of the boundary, the lithosphere-asthenosphere boundary, using earthquake waves. And this is where earthquakes face from the far side of the Earth come up towards your station, and as they pass through the boundary, they're modified. They split into P and S waves, faster and slower waves. And the relative timing that of the arrival of the P and the S at the station tells you how deep that boundary is, and the shape of those P and S waves tells you something about how sharp that boundary is. And so the other thing we saw down there was not just one reflection, but two. It's almost like a tram track, two mm-hmm. parallel reflections. And we can tell they're about 10 kilometres apart, and so we have a channel there. And so what we think is happening is that the melt, which is in very, very small quantities throughout the asthenosphere, perhaps 0.1% only throughout the asthenosphere, has actually migrates upwards and ponds near this boundary and then gets focused into a very sharp boundary because of the relative motion of the plate over the lower mantle. The asthenosphere contains fractions of what they call incompatible elements which melt out, and it's only a small amount, perhaps 0.1%, but they will rise and pond at this boundary of where that lithosphere is.
Yeah, and that makes motion, it nice and slippery.
Yeah, that makes it slippery, and if there's motion between the two, what happens is you get what's called strain localization, and you get localization of the melt into an ever-decreasingly narrow sort of channel. And that's what we think we're seeing here.
That's Professor Tim Stern from Victoria University in Wellington. Meanwhile, scientists have found that changes in sea level caused by major glacial cycles affects the thickness of the seafloor spreading out from mid-ocean ridges. The findings reported in the journal Science help explain the presence of abyssal hills, variations in topography on the seafloor forming a series of parallel hills stepping out away from the mid-ocean ridges. The study's lead author, Dr. John Crowley, undertook the research while at Harvard and Oxford universities. He says the new models developed by his team show a strong correlation between changes in sea level and large variations in the production of oceanic crust, resulting in significant changes in seafloor topography. New seafloor is formed at mid-ocean ridges as magma upwells from the mantle, erupts onto the surface and spreads. Magma can be formed either by increasing temperature or by decreasing pressure when the material is already close to its melting point temperature. The idea is that the more water there is in the ocean, the more weight there is pushing down on the seafloor, and consequently, the higher the pressure will be on the underlying shallow mantle. During glacial cycles, water is redistributed between the oceans and the continents. So, during an ice age, you have lots of water that was in the ocean being stored on land in glaciers. As that water is removed from the ocean, stored in glaciers, the lower sea level results in less pressure on the seafloor, increasing the amount of melt material in the mantle. This melt then makes it all the way to the surface, producing thicker oceanic crust than would occur during non-glaciation periods. Between glacial periods, rising sea levels increase the pressure on the seafloor, thereby reducing the amount of melt material in the mantle. Ice ages typically see sea levels change by about 100 metres over tens to hundreds of thousands of years, which is a typical glaciation cycle. The new models show that you can have corresponding changes in the topography of the seafloor by as much as hundreds of metres. To test their theory, Crowley and colleagues studied the seafloor around the mid-ocean ridge between Australia and Antarctica. The authors measured the distance between the Australia-Antarctica mid-ocean ridge and specific points on adjacent tectonic plates, as well as how fast those plates were moving. This allowed the researchers to calculate when a specific abyssal hill was formed. Amazingly, they found a very clear correlation between the formation of abyssal hills and known ice age periods of 23,000, 41,000 and 100,000 years. These specific glaciation periods are known as Milankovitch cycles, and they're triggered by regular variations in the elongation of Earth's orbit around the Sun and changes in its axial tilt. Crowley says the research demonstrates how climatic changes on the Earth's surface can be strongly linked to long-term melting and melt transport in the planet's interior.
What we've shown is that changes in sea level throughout the Earth's history can actually cause variations in the production of oceanic crust, as you mentioned.
To test that theory, of course, you need to compare the two, and you did that in our neck of the woods.
Yes, we did. So we looked at the mid-ocean ridge, which is the Australian-Antarctic ridge. So that's where the Australian and the Antarctic plates meet. And what we did was, as you suggested, we examined the seafloor in that area. You know the speed that the plate is traveling away from the ridge, and you also know the distance of a point on that plate from the ridge, then you can use the two of those to calculate the age of the points on the plate.
And when you did that, you found a correlation with known glaciation periods.
Exactly. So we're able, by using that process, we're able to take the topography information over the plate, and we're able to convert it into a variation over time. And then by analyzing that variation with time, we're able to pick out specific frequencies which correspond to ice age frequencies, and those being frequencies or periods of 23, 41, and 100,000 years. And those have to do with variations in the Earth's orbit as it goes around the Sun.
We know the Earth's orbit's not completely circular. In fact, just last month, we were actually at perihelion. It also gets more elongated at times than others. Is that what?
Yep. So there's an elongation of the orbit. There is there's also changes in the tilt of the Earth's axis at which it rotates about. And then there's also a precession of that tilting axis. And all three of those vary over time. And those are what give rise to the 23, the 41, and the 100,000 year periods. So they're all kind of specific features of the Earth's orbit that can lead to ice ages on those same timescales.
What are the implications of that?
It's important for a few reasons, I think. I mean, one of the reasons is this might help us explain the presence of abyssal hills. Now, we think that there could be other mechanisms involved in that too, but we think this could largely explain those. One of the other reasons that a lot of people are getting excited about this, and you mentioned it before, is that this work demonstrates a strong link between what's happening on the surface of the Earth with long-term climate and what's happening on the interior of the Earth with mantle melting and melt transport. So in a way, it couples together two systems that people usually study separately.
We need to look at these systems as a unified interacting system rather than as separate disciplines.
Yes, exactly. So one of my co-authors, Richard Katz, who's at Oxford, one of his active areas of research is not only looking at the increase in melt that occurs or the changes in melting that occurs in response to changes in sea level, but it's also looking at how additional melt can release additional volatiles from the Earth, such as CO2, which play a really important role in long-term climate. And so if you can imagine these changes in sea level changing melting rates within the Earth, which then lead to different amounts of CO2 being degassed from the Earth's mantle, that then feeds into the climate system, and you could get a full dynamic feedback between your long-term climate and melting in the Earth.
That's Dr. John Crowley, who undertook the research into seafloor spreading while he was at Harvard and Oxford universities. A cluster of young pulsating stars discovered near the distant regions of the Milky Way galaxy may be pinpointing the location of a previously unseen dark matter-dominated dwarf galaxy hidden behind clouds of dust on the far side of the Milky Way. Astronomers analysed near-infrared data collected by the European Southern Observatory, finding four young stars approximately 300,000 light-years away. These young stars are known as Cepheid variables, standard candles used by astronomers to measure distance. And these are the most distant Cepheid variables found near the galactic plane of the Milky Way. The study, reported in the Astrophysical Journal Letters, claims the stars appear to be associated with a dark matter-dominated dwarf galaxy, first hinted at by an analysis of ripples in the Milky Way's outer disk. The researchers found the Cepheid variables in the Norma cluster are all within 1 degree of each other. The stars can't be part of our galaxy because the disk of the Milky Way only extends about 48,000 light-years out. And so it's thought they're probably part of another galaxy, one which we haven't been able to detect through normal methods. Dark matter makes up about 23% of the mass of the universe, but it's extremely difficult to detect because it can't be seen, and it can only be detected by its gravitational interaction with normal matter. Iran has launched the first of a series of rockets carrying spy satellites into orbit. Al Alam Television is reporting the Fajir, or Dawn, satellite was placed into a 450-kilometer-high orbit on a Shafir rocket. The United States Space Surveillance System was able to confirm the detection of two objects in orbit shortly after launch, most likely the Fajir satellite and the Shafir upper stage. The 50-kilogram satellite is designed to take images of activities on the ground from space using an optical imaging payload camera capable of a 500-meter resolution. The Shafir rocket is a 22-meter-long two-stage launch vehicle based on the Shahab-3 Scud missile fitted with a North Korean Nodong engine, running nitrogen tetroxide or nitric acid as an oxidizer and either kerosene or unsymmetrical dimethylhydrazine propellant. The first Shafir rocket, launched back in 2008, was claimed a great success by Tehran. However, the rocket actually crashed and burned shortly after liftoff. The second launch attempt in 2009 was successful, placing the Omid satellite into low Earth orbit. At least three following launch attempts also failed. However, in 2011, Tehran successfully placed the Rashid-1 satellite into orbit, followed by the Navid satellite in early 2012. A further three launch attempts in 2012 and 2013 also crashed and burned, with at least one rocket exploding on the launch pad. This latest launch being the first successful flight since then. Both the satellite and the launch vehicle were built by Iran using North Korean technology as part of the Islamic Republic's push to develop an independent space program. The launch was designed to coincide with Iranian celebrations marking the 36th anniversary of the Islamic Revolution on February 11. Iran's preparing to launch at least four more satellites, the Shafir, the Tolu, the Pars, and the Qarem, which will reportedly all be using more powerful launch vehicles. Tolu will operate on a 500-kilometer-high orbit, while the Shafir satellite will fly in geostationary orbit 36,000 kilometers above the equator. Iran describes the Pars satellite as a remote sensing spacecraft, while Qarem is said to be a telecommunications satellite. Tehran's expanding space program has also seen the launch of several spacecraft containing live animals, including insects, turtles, rats, and monkeys, many of which have died during the missions. Iran's growing space activities have sent alarm bells ringing in the international community amid concerns that Tehran's space program is really being developed to provide the nation with a long-distance nuclear weapons delivery system. That's a claim denied by the oil-rich nation, which insists its nuclear program is for peaceful power generation only. But Iran has been engaged in years of protracted nuclear disarmament talks with the United States, Russia, China, Britain, and France, which are seen by military analysts as stalling tactics by Tehran so it can continue developing a secret nuclear weapons capability. On Monday, US President Barack Obama said there was no reason to again extend nuclear talks with Tehran, as the real question is whether Iran truly wants an agreement at all. Meanwhile, Tehran's continuing to produce advanced uranium enrichment centrifuges capable of making nuclear weapons-grade uranium faster than the decades-old centrifuges it currently uses. Iran's also stonewalled evidence that it secretly purchased banned nuclear technology in breach of sanctions. And there are growing concerns over Tehran's actions in preventing United Nations International Atomic Energy Agency inspectors from entering key nuclear facilities. An Atlas V rocket carrying a new next-generation communications satellite designed to provide cellular-like voice and data services to the US military has successfully blasted off from the Cape Canaveral Air Force Station in Florida. The flight by the United Launch Alliance joint venture partnership between Lockheed Martin and Boeing was the first of 13 missions the company plans for 2015. Perched on top of the rocket was the third satellite in the United States Navy's $7.3 billion Mobile User Objective System, or MUOS, a network intended to provide 3G-like cellular technology to American vehicles, ships, submarines, aircraft, and troops around the planet. The planned five-satellite constellation is designed for high-fidelity secure voice conversations, network conference calls, data relay, and video services. With two satellites already in orbit, a third on the way, and two more scheduled for launch, MUOS will supplement and eventually replace the Navy's current ultra-high frequency follow-on satellite system, providing 10 times more capacity than the current network. The 6,804-kilogram MUOS-3 satellite needed the heaviest lift version of the Atlas V rocket, complete with five strap-on solid rocket boosters. The fourth MUOS launch is planned for later this year, with a fifth bird, which will act as an in-orbit spare, due to fly in 2016. Russia's first space launch of the new year has used a Proton M rocket to place a British telecommunications satellite into orbit from the Baikonur Cosmodrome in the Central Asian Republic of Kazakhstan. The 6.7-ton Inmarsat-5F2 communications satellite is the second in a $1.6 billion fleet called Global Express. The new bird will provide broadband communication services covering the Americas and the Atlantic Ocean. The launch was the 402nd flight of the Proton, which has suffered numerous failures in recent years. Russia plans to eventually replace the Proton workhorse with the newer Angara rocket, which completed a successful maiden test flight last year. Earlier, another Russian Proton rocket had launched from the Baikonur Cosmodrome, this one carrying the new Astra 2G telecommunications satellite into orbit. The flight had been delayed by a month because of a faulty gyroscope on the rocket's Breeze-M upper stage. The mission placed the Astra 2G 35,700 kilometers above the equator just north of Madagascar. That Proton was returned to its launch pad on the same day as a Soyuz 21B rocket was rolled out and launched from Baikonur, carrying a new Earth observation satellite into orbit. The Resurs-P2 probe, which is based on the Russian Yangta K4S1 military reconnaissance satellite, was placed into a 470-kilometer high orbit, from where it will survey the Earth with high-resolution multispectral remote sensing cameras. The spacecraft's also fitted with a high-energy particle detector developed by the Moscow State University. This instrument's designed to search for antimatter and dark matter particles in cosmic radiation. Meanwhile, another Russian Soyuz rocket has been launched, this one by Arianespace from the European Space Agency's Kourou spaceport in French Guiana. The Soyuz was carrying four additional communication satellites to further expand the O3b network. Each of the four 700-kilogram Ka-band satellites launched on flight VS-10 will provide telecommunications and internet services to Asia, Africa, South America, the Middle East and Australia from equatorial orbits at an altitude of about 8,000 kilometres. And that's the show for now. If you're in the United States and you're listening to Star Stuff as a radio broadcast, don't forget you can also subscribe to the show as a weekly podcast through iTunes, or you can download it from the ABC Science website at abc.net.au/science/Star Stuff. You can also check out the Star Stuff blog, which contains all sorts of space and astronomy news we can't fit in the show, as well as some spectacular space images and other things I find amusing. Just Google starstuffblog.tumblr.com. That's all one word and in lowercase, and that's Tumblr without the E. And don't forget the official ABC Star Stuff Twitter feed for the latest Star Stuff broadcast times, radio stations, and publishing details. Just type in the @ symbol, followed by ABC Star Stuff, all one word and in lowercase, and you'll never miss a thing.